From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Arthur Andersen accountants kept Enron's books, and Enron's books have exploded. Now Arthur Andersen itself is hanging by a thread. 6 months ago, it was an American institution. Today, the Department of Justice is prosecuting the firm for illegally destroying documents in the Enron investigation. Dozens of major clients have abandoned the firm. The CEO has quit, and the company itself is coming apart. As employees rally with the slogan, "I am Arthur Andersen," Andersen officials have refused to publicly admit any wrongdoing. Former Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker has entered the fray with a plan to save the embattled firm. Should Arthur Andersen be saved? Or does justice require that the whole firm go down? Joining me now from New York is James Surowiecki, financial columnist with The New Yorker. Good evening. Welcome, James Surowiecki. Good to have you. This is quite a saga unfolding here, James Surowiecki, and I'm sure that many of our listeners have not kept up with it blow by blow. Almost every day, there's major new news. Today, the worldwide board of Arthur Andersen Worldwide meeting in London trying to find a new CEO, hasn't found one yet today. Merger plans with KPMG, which appeared to be one way the company might be saved, have fallen apart today. Can you bring us up to date on the kind of string of events that has brought this huge accounting firm to its knees?
Well, there are two things to keep in mind, I think. The first is that Arthur Andersen, I think, has come under a lot of fire and a lot of justifiable fire for the fact that it essentially allowed Enron to get away with a lot of what at this point look like very questionable shenanigans in terms of the way it was financing its operations. And, you know, Andersen was Enron's chief accountant, as you said, so it was its accountants were signing off on this. The crisis that is actually forcing the company into the peril that it is now in has to do specifically with the destruction of documents by primarily people in Andersen's Houston office, which is to say they had a whole series of documents relating to the Enron case, and they were, you know, just piles of them were shredded. I mean, the stories, assuming they're true, of what happened in that office when sort of things started to break and it became clear that there were going to be subpoenas, et cetera, quite extraordinary, you know, basically all-night sessions of shredding, et cetera.
And the scandal also seems to lean heavily on the link between what was going on in Houston at the Enron headquarters, where Andersen people were, and the American headquarters of Arthur Andersen in Chicago, and the email traffic between them, a memo that at one point seemed to sanction what was going on with Enron's books and then tried to amend that sanction, and then a lot of that traffic just disappeared.
Right. I mean, and that, again, gets to the question of sort of where did that go. But there were sort of suggestions, and in some cases, I mean, as you mentioned, the email accounts that looked sort of explicitly to, if not essentially order the destruction, then at least to accept and, in fact, sort of, you know, sanction the destruction. And
wink, so, wink, nod, nod, it wouldn't be bad.
Exactly. And the language they used was sort of, you know, it was all framed in such a way as, you know, basically, of course, companies do destroy documents after a certain point, you know, rather than keep everything around. But this was done in such a way that made it sound as if, well, if you haven't gotten around to doing this, it might be a good time to do it. And that obviously was very questionable in light of what happened. So all of this has essentially precipitated this enormous crisis. But I would, you know, even though it is the obstruction of justice charge that is that really, I think, holds the key to whether or not the institution will continue to exist, I think the first part of the story, which is to say Andersen's role in essentially facilitating Enron's questionable at best behavior, I think is also very important in understanding what's happened over the last, a couple months.
What's your reading of Andersen's role there, James Surowiecki? How unusual do you think this was in the late 90s and the early 2000s for an accounting firm to be signing off on the kind of practices that Enron was using to very aggressively work its books?
Well, I think, unfortunately, it was probably not too unusual, and I know you'll be speaking to that point a little bit later on, but I think there's no question that in the late 90s, as the bull market continued to rage and as companies got incredibly adept at essentially using financial tools to, you know, either boost their earnings or make their stock price look better, that accountants essentially abandoned the role of objective critic. And that also had something to do with, as I'm sure you're familiar with, the boom in accounts serving as consultants. So that instead of just being an accountant for a company, they would also consult for that company.
And, so they'd be vouching for the books and at the same time guiding the company.
Exactly. And so that I think is something that was happening in places other than Enron. The one thing to say about Anderson, though, is that its record does look remarkably bad. It isn't just, of course, Enron. It's also Waste Management, which was one of the largest and most questionable cases of defrauding shareholders. Six former Waste Management executives were recently indicted. Arthur Anderson, I think, paid a $200 million fine.
Was anyone fired or penalized within Arthur Anderson for that?
Anderson, people were dismissed, but the company itself actually never admitted guilt. It was one of those sort of settlements. But the Waste Management case, which had to do, with essentially the way the earnings numbers were reported, was highly questionable. Arthur Anderson also happens to be the accountant for Global Crossing, which is another company that has come under fire for at least sketchy behavior, if not at this point we don't know if it's illegal or not. So Anderson's record does not look very good, even relative, I think, to some of the other big five firms.
Now they've got Paul Volcker in there. You can't get a much taller tree in the realm of American business to try and patch things up. Does he have a prayer?
Well, the interesting thing is his plan is not a bad one in the sense that he's actually trying to separate the auditing business from the consulting business, which is exactly what we were just talking about. And, that probably is a good idea going forward. That actually is probably a good idea for the whole industry. On the other hand, Anderson is unwilling to admit and has been completely unwilling to admit any wrongdoing or any guilt whatsoever. And in the absence of that, the obstruction of justice charge, I imagine, will continue. The other thing that's interesting is that Volcker is also running into flack from within the company itself, primarily, I think, both because there's some desire not to just totally restructure the firm, and also because presumably a company that's just auditing will not be as profitable or as big as a company that is able to do both.
And Volcker's plan to save Arthur Anderson seems to depend entirely on getting the Department of Justice to take back or to defer this indictment for obstruction of justice, which so far they show no sign of doing.
Right, and it sounds, at least from the various accounts, that one of the reasons they show no sign of doing so is that Anderson has been remarkably obstinate in the face of the idea of making any kind of concession. So that it seems as if there was a possibility that of a deferral of prosecution, where essentially they would have just agreed not to prosecute for a certain number of years, and if Anderson did nothing wrong in that period, then the indictment would essentially be washed off the books. But in the absence of any concessions from Anderson, I think justice is going to go forward. And accepting the fact that to some degree Anderson is probably being made a little bit of an example here for the sins of the accounting industry as a whole, I do think that Anderson needs to understand that and recognize that Enron is the biggest bankruptcy in U.S. Corporate history, and that Anderson's behavior was dubious at best. And so recognizing all those things, the fact that they have refused to make any concessions is kind of interesting.
Your bottom line, James Surowiecki, does Arthur Anderson deserve to go down?
Well, I certainly think that the criminal charges are probably in order. Whether or not that means that the firm itself should cease to exist is probably another question. I personally, though, don't feel that there's any great investment in whether or not Arthur Anderson exists. I'll say one thing quickly. One of the things that's interesting about what's happened in the last few months is that a lot of companies apparently are going now to smaller accounting firms, are essentially starting to reconsider whether or not they actually need to be with one of the big five. And in the sense that these five companies essentially had an oligopoly on Fortune 500 accounting, that doesn't seem to be a bad thing that other companies will essentially be entering into this arena.
The whole structure may change.
Yeah.
James Surowiecki, thanks so much for joining us this evening.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
James Surowiecki writes the financial column for the New Yorker magazine. What should be the fate of Arthur Anderson? The question is, will killing the firm mean justice has been done? Will it fix the accounting industry? And who's ultimately responsible for what went wrong? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined in the studio by Krishna Palapu. He's professor of accounting at Harvard Business School. Good evening and welcome, Professor Palapu.
Good evening.
And from the studios of Vermont Public Radio, by our own On Point news analyst, Jack Beattie. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Professor Palapu, you've looked at the whole industry of accounting, and it's all on trial one way or another right now. The Wall Street Journal is these days devoting a whole page or pages each day to companies whose books are now under fire, whose bookkeeping is under fire. What do you think are the most important – what perspective should we bring to this? Arthur Andersen is now hanging by a thread. Clients are fleeing it in droves. The company's overseas wings are breaking off and joining up with other major accounting firms. We've seen that just today it appears as though a global merger with KPMG, which might have saved it in large part, is falling apart. There's no CEO at the moment, and they haven't come up with a new one. All this – in the aftermath of it coming out that Enron's books were badly kept and that documents were shredded in great number, which led to this indictment for obstruction of justice by the Department of Justice. Is this the correct fate for Arthur Andersen, and will this line of attack fix the problems in American accounting today?
There are two separate issues here. One, what to do with Andersen. Mm-hmm. Which is really a short-term issue in some sense, because I think the real deeper issue is how do we reform the accounting profession as a whole, because I think what happened to Andersen could easily happen to the other big four accounting firms. In fact, they may already have signed off on certain firms' financial statements that might come home to roost in future.
So there could be a lot of other time bombs ticking out there.
Yes, because I think the issues are really fundamental about the way the business has been organized and run in the accounting profession. The pressures that James described in terms of the bull market, earnings management pressures on CEOs from Wall Street, and through that process, the pressures on audit profession to relax their standards.
Are you saying then that even at the Big Five, which were supposed the accounting firms, which are supposed to stand for the very integrity of American business, a kind that they generally or all of them became accomplices in what's often called aggressive bookkeeping, but now is being called cooking the books?
Well, yeah, I think accomplices might be a strong word because in some fundamental sense, auditors are intermediaries between the firms and shareholders. Mm-hmm. So they have two clients, essentially. And the question is, can they be serving two masters at the same time and maintain that professional balance that they need to maintain? And I think in the last 10, 15 years, probably the balance went out of whack a little bit.
Why?
There are several reasons. I think one, there is a real confusion in the minds of auditors about who the real client is. There are three possibilities. One is the traditional definition, which is investors. But the investors don't pay them.
Not directly.
The boards appoint them. So the audit committee and the board of directors is another possibility. Mm-hmm. And the third one is the people that they work with on a daily basis, which is the CFO and the CEO of the company,
right,
who also happen to write the checks most often.
The ones whose faces they have to see.
Exactly. And I think there's a real confusion in the minds of auditors about who their real clients are, and increasingly they're feeling like their clients are CEOs and CFOs, especially when you throw in the consulting engagements that come with working with those people.
Jack Beattie, you can hear in Professor Palapu's description the kind of pressures that came to bear on all accounting firms in the bull market of the late 90s when the CFO was looking at you and saying, hey, I need to do this to make this firm push ahead.
Yeah, you certainly can, and it's easy to understand. There was almost a culture of spin there. I mean, we evolved something like investor capitalism in the 90s, where the stakeholders, the other stakeholders in the corporation, the employees, the communities, and so on, were all subordinated to the stockholder, and the stockholder is liable to illusion. He's liable to euphoria. He's liable to spin. And you could easily see a whole culture of this saying, well, listen, you know, we'll keep this company going by the momentum of the investors. So you keep feeding that sort of illusion, hope. And the accountants, who are supposed to be the, you know, the guys who rain on your parade, you can easily see how they just sort of, they get it. Oh, that's true. If these books go through, it'll raise the stock price, and therefore, essentially, it'll predict the stock price.
And yet all things must pass. And now that market has passed. And a lot of accounting firms, Arthur Andersen foremost, is standing naked in the rain. Is a death sentence the right sentence for Arthur Andersen? Should Arthur Andersen pay for the Enron scandal with its life? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
At WBUR.org.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the fate of Arthur Andersen. They were Enron's accountant, and we know what happened to Enron. Now Arthur Andersen is in deep trouble. The company is coming apart day by day. It may sound abstract, but if you've got a dollar in the stock market or an interest in a company, you've got to care about how the books are being kept. The question is, should Arthur Andersen pay for the Enron scandal with its life? Will bringing down Arthur Andersen fix the accounting industry? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined in the studio by Professor Krishna Palapu. He's a professor of accounting at Harvard Business School. By Jack Beatty on the line from Vermont. And right now on the line by Andrew. Good evening, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm thinking about your intro and the first segment that you had with Mr. Sawicki, I think it was. That, I think, is sort of characteristic of a lot of what's going on here. I think it was very slanted, and I think it contained some outright factual inaccuracies.
What slant, Andrew?
Hang Andersen, go after the big guys, stick some knives in the biggest target available.
Well, that's what we're talking about. Is that the right thing? That's what seems to be happening right now. What's your view, Andrew?
Well, let me take a couple of specific points that you had. Mr. Sawicki said there was no admission of guilt or wrongdoing. 2 weeks after the matter broke, Joe Berardino, the former CEO of Andersen, was down in front of Congress saying, yes, in fact, we did, or Andersen did make an error in judgment.
An error in judgment, but is that different from conceding, a real professional error?
Yes. No, it's not.
Mm-hmm.
He said, we made a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Second of all, you said in your intro, Andersen keeps the books. I'd just like to point out, as a matter of fact, that no auditor keeps the books for a company. They issue an opinion on the books, which are kept by the management of Enron.
Point taken, Andrew. But, you know, they are seen, it's their signature that ultimately goes in the annual report saying these books have been correctly kept.
No, in fact, they say these books present fairly in all material aspects the results and financial condition of the company.
The understood, but
opinion letter also includes language that indicates that our tests are examining on a test basis the financial statements and the financial transactions.
Andrew, you seem pretty familiar with this. Have you got a special relationship with Andersen Accounting?
Yes, in fact, I am an employee of Andersen.
Ah, so there's a lot on the line here, and we understand that there's 28,000 Andersen employees around the world. Do you feel like the employees are being sent down the river unjustly?
Absolutely. I think the Department of Justice is looking for a great big corpse to throw on the floor in front of the American public, and I think that it's completely unfair.
Let me ask Krishna Palapu here in the studio. Here's an Andersen, Arthur Andersen employee. He's looking at his job and some piece of his career being in imminent danger, and he says it's wrong, it's unfair. What's your view?
I think Andrew has a point. I think there are many, many villains in this story that doesn't absolve what Andersen has done. And I think Andersen needs to be held accountable for what they have not done. But right now, they're the biggest target that is available for, you know, punishing. And so in some sense, everybody is piling on them. But I think if we really want to fix the total problem in the capital markets, I think just looking at Anderson is not going to do it.
Well, we'll step back and look at the total market. But in the Enron case, we had a giant bankruptcy. We have shredded documents. We have a charge of obstruction of justice. Let me ask our caller, Andrew. That doesn't look good, does it? And shouldn't someone step up and take responsibility? And isn't it the market ultimately that's delivering this terrible verdict on Anderson with clients fleeing?
Well, as far as I know, the client flight didn't really start until the Department of Justice filed the indictment against Anderson. And that was the point at which Anderson's ability to sign audit opinions came into question. One of the things that hasn't really come out is mm-hmm. that the Department of Justice played this real hardball with us and said, plead guilty or we're going to indict you. If we plead guilty to that felony, then by SEC regulations, the firm can no longer sign audit opinions, and then a great deal of our business goes away, so the firm may as well close up its doors.
But what if the firm is guilty of the charge?
Well, that's for the courts to decide, isn't it?
Well, it is, and that's what's in process right now. And in the meantime, it looks as though the markets are saying, hey, this is an association we can't afford to keep.
No, it's an association that they can't afford the risk of. There's an indictment out there, so there's a question as to whether or not we're going to be able to sign the financials. An audit is a year-long process, beginning mm-hmm. at the beginning of the year, going through all the quarterlies, and through the end of the year. If halfway through the year, all of a sudden the verdict comes back guilty and verdicts have been wrong, and for the record, I don't think we're guilty, all of a sudden there are going to be a whole lot of firms who have to get a new auditor.
Andrew, you're an employee of Arthur Anderson. Do you feel damaged by what the Arthur Anderson partners in Houston did for Enron?
Absolutely. I think they were totally irresponsible, and I think the firm took the correct action in dismissing David Duncan, and I think that's where the Department of Justice should be looking right now.
Mm-hmm. Andrew, thanks very much for your call tonight. That really is the question. How big a price should Arthur Anderson pay? Right now, it appears to be potentially within days of paying the ultimate price. Krishna Palipu, you were saying that you're not sure that Anderson's downfall will bring the kind of changes that the accounting industry needs. What are those changes, and what might lead to them coming to pass?
First thing to understand is that the accounting problems are symptom of a broader disease. And the disease is at the two bookends of the capital markets equation that one needs to think about. On the one hand, you have the money managers who are putting in billions of dollars into companies based presumably on some analysis.
Analysis within their own firms.
Yeah. But in fact, there is no major money manager that got fired as a result of having invested in Enron. So the question is, where is accountability there?
Mm-hmm.
By and large, what's happening is, and in fact, by the way, this should be put in the context of the $2 trillion of market cap that disappeared in NASDAQ as a result of dot-com meltdown,
mm-hmm.
where also money managers put in a lot of money into companies that, in fact, became worthless later on.
So you're saying don't just whip the accountants. It was actually the entire capital investment community who was a little bit asleep.
Because ultimately, you have to fix the demand side of the equation for information, which is coming from money managers who demand information to make decisions.
But if books are not being correctly kept and accounted, how can money managers make good decisions? And in the Enron case, there were enormous bumps under the rug that couldn't be clearly seen because of the very bookkeeping.
Well, for each dollar that the company was reporting as it's on the balance sheet, the stock price was $7. So even if you assume that there was nothing wrong with the $1 that they reported,
mm-hmm.
you still have to ask, you know, how come people are paying $7 for each dollar that the company was reporting on its books? And that $7 really is manufactured by the money manager's calculations.
So we take your point. There are bookends here, but tonight we really want to look at that accounting bookend.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is part of the reason why I think the accounting profession has been so complacent is because I think they developed a view over time that nobody cares really about the information that they produce.
Mm-hmm.
Because the people who are using that information really seem to be doing very superficial analysis using that information. So
all riding moonbeams anyway.
Exactly. So the only time there is a wake-up call is when there is a major scandal rather than on an ongoing basis when companies are reporting their financial statements, anybody, whether carefully, is looking at them or not. So part of the reason why I think accountants really are not taking their job as seriously, and in fact, hiding behind some of the technicalities like our previous caller was talking about, saying that's not our job. You know, really what we do is according to this and that. And this is like a mechanic that you hire to look at a car saying, geez, you know, I kicked the tires and I'm saying this is a great car. And that's our rules. So in some sense, accountants, I think, have developed all these
rationalizations
for not doing their job, in part because they think that the market is not willing to pay really any attention to this kind of stuff.
Mm. Jack Beatty, you hear the breath of a wild decade you can feel in what Krishna Palepu is saying. The investors didn't care. The accountants knew the investors didn't care, so the accountants didn't feel like they really had to be that accountable.
Yeah, it was a decade where Amazon.com for a while there seemed to have a higher market value, a company that had never made a profit, had a higher market value than, what, Ford Motor Company or something. Suppose you did the books on Amazon and said, this company isn't making money. No one was paying attention to that.
But, Jack, isn't that exactly the kind of time where we need to be able to count on something? Shouldn't accounting be like a kind of solid hardware, even when a whole market is taking flight?
I couldn't agree more. And here is where the in the early 90s under Clinton, the Clinton SEC tried to get this business of the accountant wearing two hats as advisor to the company and as accountant to disallow that. And with some strenuous opposition from Congress, led by Joe Lieberman of Connecticut and other Democrats, that was resisted. People have been aware of this problem for a long time, but the lobbying from these accounting firms into Congress has essentially nixed reform until this crisis came. But, you know, I want to pick up on something Andrew was saying, and almost more suggesting, and I'm wondering here, you know, it's Enron that is the underlying disturbance here. It's Enron that was perpetrating, if it was perpetrating, a fraud. And the accountants were sort of, blessing that at one level or another. But the underlying problem is Enron. And, of course, Enron is the most connected company in the world. And I'm just wondering here whether Anderson, the celerity with which the Bush Justice Department indicted it, is a way of kind of saying it's all on Anderson. And Enron, well, we don't know. And maybe indictments aren't going to follow there. I think that was a sort of suggestion, and it makes my eyebrows raise a tick or two.
Yeah, I imagine it does. A lot of callers want to join our conversation. Let's turn to them. Gray is on the line. Welcome, Gray. You're on the air.
Perfect segue. As far as I understand, one of the reasons why the Justice Department was so infuriated by this whole procedure is because of waste management. That was one of the previous large clients of Anderson, and as far as I understand, it was a $1.4 billion adjustment.
Indictments in the company, not in Anderson.
And I think they also paid a lot of fines and that sort of stuff. And
so you're saying that the Department of Justice was upset because this was the second time, they were determined to be tough with Arthur Anderson?
I think in general, I mean, I think they also need to send a signal to the accounting world in general. I mean, I think there's a lot of collusion and there's a lot of this pandering back and forth between corporate management and a lot of the consulting arrangements, and I think they really needed to, they were sick and tired of it, and I don't blame it at all for shooting a blow across the accounting world's bow here.
So Gray, you're weeping no tears for Arthur Anderson. What about those 28,000 employees going down with the ship?
Well, I mean, this happens a lot. I mean, I'm in the .com world, and a lot of my peers have gone down with the ships as well, and It is sad, but it's part of the realities of the accounting world, right? That is their lifeblood. I mean, the Justice Department, like you said, is not the one killing them. It is the market, and this is the land that they live in. This is where they are. They have to be very, very careful, because the instant they start talking trash or just talking, making no sense, then who's going to believe them? That's just unfortunately the world they're in.
How do we know what straight up is anymore? Gray, thanks for your call. Let's go to Lloyd. Lloyd, you're on the air.
How's it going?
Real well, thanks.
Excellent. I want to reiterate the whole Enron White House trashing Anderson. My legal firm in Riga, Latvia, that I hired to do my family's work in Riga, Latvia, is an Anderson affiliate.
And in far-flung Latvia.
What's that?
In far-flung Latvia.
Riga, Latvia.
Okay.
I can tell you that these people are honest, hardworking people,
mm-hmm.
and they don't deserve the firm-wide indictment that this Justice Department is involved in. And quite frankly, the speed by which they came out with an indictment is you know, obviously politically directed, because they should have investigated this a great deal more. And I honestly believe that it was Enron that brought the Houston office into collusion with their fraud. And the Enron White House came out with this indictment so quickly to deflect the attention, because let's face it, Bush pulled off on the third day of his administration, received an Energy Department order restricting Enron's trading in California,
mm-hmm.
and allowed them to go back in there. And,
right. Lloyd,
and
we hear you. Here's another voice for going after the big kahuna, for going after Enron and not beating up on Anderson. Krishna Palepu, what's your sense of the relative vigor with which the government has gone after Enron and gone after its accountant, Arthur Anderson? Is it the right balance?
Yeah. I think the final judgment is yet to be made, because I read in the papers that they're working on indictments of the management of Enron, ex-management, Fasto and
mm-hmm.
Skilling.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there are two components to this thing. One is the market consequences, and that's, I think, the reason why they're going after the accounting firm, because it has a much broader reach beyond just Enron.
The whole market
issue.
Needs to trust that American accounting is upright.
Yeah, exactly. So I think this is not just a matter of retribution. It's also a matter of cleaning up so that, in fact, we will have a functioning capital market.
Mm-hmm. What about that very point? Do you think that going fiercely after Arthur Anderson will have the effect of cleaning up the entire accounting industry?
I'm not so sure. It may actually create a bunker mentality like we heard from people like Andrew.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think there are lots of voices in the accounting profession that realize that something needs to be done to improve. And the best strategy has to be to encourage those people to reform from within, because we cannot wipe out a whole profession. And by indicting a whole firm and creating this kind of fear and backlash, in fact, we could be creating defensiveness and decrease the likelihood that the other companies
mm-hmm.
will be willing to, in fact, want to change, because that will implicitly admit that we are like Anderson, too.
Well, I understand defensiveness about books that have already been signed off on, but going forward, don't you think it will cause other accounting firms to put out the message openly or privately, look, no more bending the rules. We've got to play it straight from now on.
But I think, you know, it's simplistic to say that that's really the only problem, because things are actually more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm.
There are many judgments where things are not black and white.
Of course.
Also, accountant, the auditing profession has a big influence on the way accounting rules are written. And many times they have written the rules in a convenient way so that it's easy to audit rather than to really communicate the underlying economics to the capital markets. And we need reform there so that, in fact, the rules truly allow investors to see what's going on inside the firm rather than make it easy for auditors to audit.
That might make auditing services more expensive.
Yeah, that might make auditing service more risky and more expensive.
More risky because they'd have to pay closer attention and be responsible for finer line detail.
Exactly. Also, the real question of expertise, attracting expertise, auditing has become a mass market type of profession.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the number of clients a major audit firm like Anderson or KPMG has, and compare that with the number of clients that McKinsey, a consulting firm, might have, or Goldman Sachs, mm-hmm. which is an investment banking firm, might have, the numbers are very large for these audit firms, and as a result, they have not been able to invest in expertise inside their firm as much as they need to.
We're digging into the accounting industry. Arthur Anderson, looks like it may soon pay the ultimate price for its involvement with Enron. What do you think? Is a death sentence the right sentence for Arthur Anderson? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking tonight at the fate of Arthur Anderson, the accounting firm that was the accountant for Enron. Is it right for 28,000 Arthur Anderson employees to pay for the acts of a few with their professional lives? And where do accountants stand these days in your ethical hierarchy? Above lawyers? Above Enron chieftains? or not. Is a death sentence the right sentence for Arthur Andersen? We're joined by Krishna Pallapu, who is professor of accounting at Harvard Business School. Big issue on the table now is Paul Volcker. He's been trying to get his arms around this great, enormous company, 83, I think, what's the right word? Not branches, but manifestations of Arthur Andersen worldwide, many of them already breaking off from the mothership, merging with other major accounting firms. He's trying to save the American operation. Do you think at this point there's still any chance that he can do it?
It's going to be tough, in my opinion, because auditing is a trust business. And I think this indictment really has destroyed the trust in Andersen, I think. There is still a chance, and if there is somebody who can pull it off, it would be somebody of that stature, Paul Volcker. But I think it's going to be a tough thing, because you are seeing every day clients deserting, employees getting demoralized, and so time is running out, in my opinion.
And so far, no sign the Department of Justice will withdraw this indictment. It gave, we read it in today's newspapers, it gave Arthur Andersen the chance to have the indictment deferred. But that was on contingent on them admitting to some wrongdoing they weren't willing to admit to.
Yeah, and this is really puzzling to me, because I think that there are two levels of thinking here. One would be to really see this as a Houston office problem. But it seems like the Department of Justice is seeing this as a firm-wide orchestrated kind of criminal activity. And that's, I think... it's really puzzling why they're taking that stance, because I'm not sure I have seen any evidence that suggests that this is a deliberate criminal enterprise, which is what they're calling Enron, calling Andersen mm-hmm. today.
Mm-hmm.
There may be mistakes, there may be bad judgments, but it's not clear to me that actually bringing down a whole firm really is the appropriate thing at this point.
We read from James O'Toole. He's a professor at the Center for Effective Organizations at the University of Southern California. He writes in the New York Times that the moral analysis behind the I Am Andersen campaign that's been put forward by the companies on behalf of employees is muddled, to say the least. He says Andersen partners seem to forget that they all shared in the profits from handsome fees they collected from Enron. Now they cry foul when they are all paying the price, the threat of unemployment, for their collective failure to keep a clean house. So some people outside the Department of Justice are saying, well, you can't just say it was Houston and seal it off at that. But yet, we all see that there's some kind of an example being made at the expense of thousands of people, in this case, of Arthur Andersen.
Because there's a middle ground. I think the civil penalty that is charged will be shared by all partners. Mm-hmm. It is not as if it's going to be just paid by the Houston office.
Mm-hmm.
So you can do that and still not indict the whole firm and destroy the whole firm. So it's not clear to me that simply because the responsibility has to be shared, everybody has to go out of business.
Yeah, but that seems to be the track we're on right now. Ben is on the line. Welcome, Ben. You're on the air.
Hi. I've got two brief points I'd like to make.
Please.
I think one is that we shouldn't focus so heavily on the large publicly held companies, but also on smaller privately held companies, because I think they actually aren't really held to the same public standard.
In their accounting practices, Ben?
Yes, exactly, because they're not really in the public eye in the same way. Just as an example, I was a senior manager in a small Boston area firm for about 4 years, and the accountant, when he left, told me that he had enough information to close the company within 48 hours.
But he hadn't done it.
But he wouldn't. You know, I don't think there's enough incentive for him to do it. So I think there's a whole other kind of smaller private firm story to be told.
Mm-hmm.
And secondarily, I'm also pursuing an MBA currently, and I think after studying managerial and financial accounting, the impression a lot of us have is that managerial accounting, which is about internal information, is really the truth about the numbers, whereas financial accounting is really how to lie with the numbers to the public or to banks and financial institutions.
Mm-hmm.
Not explicitly, but implicitly, there are many different ways that you can kind of, you know, present the numbers.
That's a fascinating point.
It's very complex. Mm-hmm. So I think those are two perspectives I'd like to add to the conversation.
Got it, Ben, and we thank you for them. Krishna Pallapu, to this last point, you said earlier, we think of accounting as black and white, but it's not. Should the whole system of accounting somehow be tightened up so it gets a little closer to black and white, or are we always going to have these gray areas that Ben refers to?
In fact, my thinking would be the other way around. We need more judgment. Part of the problems we have are a result of knife-edge rules.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in Enron, all the partnerships that, in fact, became questionable in accounting terms were all accounted for using very mechanical knife edge type of rules.
That so say very that, technically,
yeah, very technical,
it was, right?
Yeah, and to the extent that it's very easy to structure these transactions just to qualify for this accounting treatment, violating the spirit of the economic intent. And so my feeling would be we should be going back to the days where we had more judgment, and then increase the responsibility of the professional judgment that people inside the firm have to make and the auditors need to make and hold people accountable for them.
Here's where Americans quake when you can't rely on law but have to rely on the value system of each individual accountant. Wow, Scott is on the line. Welcome, Scott. You're on the air.
Thank you. It strikes me that in a period of time when it's more important to get quarterly results than annual results, and more important that shareholders be happy this week and not over the long term, that this puts on some level an undue amount of pressure that is really beyond the control of any auditor, and forces them to respond in a level both to the corporation and ultimately to the shareholders that I think on some level is unreasonable. I mean, we all understand the auditors are professionals. We also understand that they accept the service responsibility and the obligations that go
right.
with it. But
you say the pressure is just too great for anyone to resist.
Yeah.
Well, how about that, Krishna Pelapu? That's accountants are there to resist pressure, aren't they? Isn't that their job?
Yeah, that's
Isn't
their
that
job.
Why we hire big accounting firms?
Yeah, that's their job, and they should resist. It's not an excuse, in my opinion, even though I think the basic point about the dysfunctionality of the capital markets is also important for us to kind of think about.
Jack Beatty?
Excuse me, I didn't want to interrupt the professor. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Jack.
Oh, I was just going to ask you, isn't this sort of implicit conflict of interest that Scott or our caller was just mentioning, isn't this one reason why some people have suggested that accountants have to be paid by the stockholders instead of by the company, that somebody else has to pay them to break that connection?
Yeah, I mean, that's implicitly they are being paid by the shareholders because managers take shareholders'
sure.
money and pay it. But the client right now is the CEO.
Yes.
I think there is an intermediate situation here. I think the board has to really become much more visible in the equation. And the board has to be the true client because in some sense it's very difficult to imagine the shareholders, thousands of them getting together and doing anything.
Sure.
But
sure.
the board is supposed to be their representatives.
Mm-hmm.
They're their first line of defense. So in fact, I think that as I was saying before, the other side of the equation that where things have failed, in my opinion, is at the board level.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if we want the auditors to do their job well, on the one hand, the money managers have to do their job well, and on the other hand, the board members have to do their job well, because those are the two real clients mm-hmm. that can deflect some of these pressures away from auditors as they're right now seeing, because they see themselves just working for the CEO.
But what we hear there is that this is going to be really difficult to fix. It's not even as simple as fixing the accounting industry. You're saying you have to fix the entire capital market. You've got to fix the sense of responsibility of every board of directors. How on earth do we get started on that?
Well, I don't think it's as complicated as it might look like, especially on the board side. I think that what we need to do is first create much more direct connection between the auditors and the board of directors. Today, the board of directors essentially sees its job as appointing the auditor and meeting the auditor for a few hours during the year. And much of the interaction really takes place with the management. I think we need to change that, and there have to be better processes where the board has a much better handle on what the auditors are up to. And the auditors start feeling that the board is going to appreciate if they actually come and give bad news. Right now, there is no incentive for auditors to come and give bad news because they think that nobody cares inside the company. Mm. The CEO most certainly doesn't care. And the question is, who are they going to go to? And if the board is not seen for them as a real client, they're not going to be able to do that.
Well, there's a big signal going up right now in Arthur Andersen's case, and we'll see how it plays out over time in boardrooms across the country. Krishna Pelapu, I want to thank you very much for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
Krishna Pelapu, who is professor of accounting at Harvard Business School. And Jack, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
In a moment, finding five sentences worth of common ground in the Middle East crisis. This is On Point. Leonard Marcus and Raja Kamal are colleagues at Harvard University. One is an American Jew. The other is an Arab, originally from Lebanon. Together, they've come up with a proposal that they believe can help rekindle the possibility of peaceful compromise between Israel and the Palestinian Authority. They've written an uncomplicated speech, only 5 lines long, that they hope to have Ariel Sharon and Yasser Arafat read simultaneously 1 week from today. In this radio diary, Leonard Marcus and Raja Kamal talk about their plan and read the 5 sentences they hope will open the door for peace.
My name is Leonard Marcus, and I am the director of the Program for Healthcare Negotiation and Conflict Resolution at the Harvard School of Public Health. Our intent with the speech is to find 5 very simple, very straightforward sentences that we believe they might be able to agree on. These are points upon which the 2 men, we believe, will be able to hopefully both read, and we believe that these are points that symbolically will mean a great deal to people in the region. For them even to gain some synchronous declaration of these very important facts on the ground and demonstrate, in fact, by virtue of the fact that they're saying the speech at the same time, that there could be agreement on these very, very basic facts, we think will just open the door one small measure, enough to consider the possibility of getting these 2 men to stop the killing and start the talking.
I am Raja Kamal. I am the Director of International Development at the John F. Kennedy School of Government, Harvard University. I grew up in Lebanon, and I've always suffered continuously until I came into this country in the mid-70s from conflict going on in that region, whether it was an Arab-Israeli war or civil war, and I've really had enough of it. I hate for this whole conflict to keep on going on right now, and I realize that a lot of people must be doing a lot of compromises and sacrifices in order to achieve some permanent peace, and I see there's a lot of commonality and overwhelming similarities that exist in that region rather than some differences. And there is no reason why we should not build up a foundation, and we feel that the 5 sentences that are going to be very much the foundation to achieve some level of humility, level of humble beginning, let's say, and civility that we can build on. And once we achieve that level of decency and level of common understanding, we can give it back to the professionals to build up proper peace around it.
Raja and I realize that though we come from very different pasts, in fact, there is a common bond between us. My past is as son of a Holocaust survivor. And though we have those different paths, we recognize that we share a common hope for a resolution to the conflict in the Middle East. The speech reads as follows. Our peoples have experienced months of painful killing.
This killing has neither enhanced our security nor our well-being, and it is unlikely that it will achieve those objectives while continuing on our current path.
There are numerous economic, health, educational, and societal benefits that we can achieve if we return to talking with one another.
We must regard this choice between killing and talking as one that we ultimately make together and one for which we must take mutual responsibility.
While there are many differences, there are also many similarities amongst our peoples in culture, beliefs, histories, aspirations, and in way of life, all of which can help us reach beyond our divides to unite us as a people, committed to finding ways to live side by side with dignity, peace, and security in a region that we ultimately must learn to.
Leonard Marcus is director of the Program for Healthcare Negotiation and Conflict Resolution at the Harvard School for Public Health. Raja Kamal is director for International Development at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government. Listeners, we'd like to hear from you. Are events in the news affecting you in a personal way? If you have a story that would make a good radio diary, email us. The address is onpoint@wbur.org. Or mail us your ideas. The address is 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can listen to other radio diaries on our website. Log on to onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point from WBUR, Boston.